I am Robert Sickles, and I am here with special guest star
Tarek El Siwi.
Yep, special guest star Tarek El Siwi, although he does answer to Tariq.
Or Tarek.
Tariq El Wheezy, which is how I always misspell your name in emails. So glad to have my friend and colleague Tarek here today, as we are going to talk about Dune, Denis Villeneuve's 2021 film Dune, which I suppose was a 2019 or 2020 film that was held because of the pandemic. So it was recently released simultaneously on HBO and in theaters. So the first question I want to ask you, Tarek, is can you tell me about your relationship with Dune? Like, what was your knowledge of it before coming into the movie?
Excellent question. I think that I was been thinking about that question, getting ready to talk to you about it. It almost renders me incapable of talking about Dune because my connection with Dune is rich and deep. So I first read Dune when I was maybe 9, 10 years old. It was the first serious series of books that I read after Lord of the Rings, and amongst the first novels I ever read, and I became an addict. So I've been so familiar with the story for my entire life. And my relationship with that, I think, is going to be different than your average viewer because, you know, I grew up as an Arab American kid, and I saw this, you know, in Dune. I saw all these Arabic phrases and all these Arabic words and all these Arabic concepts, and I was mystified. I was absolutely amazed. So for the first time, really, you know, I'd never seen any kind of thought or representation of Arabs or Muslims in the future, and I loved it. I fell in love with Dune right away. So I've been involved with the story, for 40 years now. I've consumed the books. I've read the books maybe, 3 or 4 times each. So when you add 6 books, that's 20 times. I've seen all of the films, or both of the, well, the film and the television series. I've seen, I've watched them repeatedly as well. I don't know if we're going to talk about the 1984 version, how weird it was. But I've been involved with this film, with this story, with this universe my whole life. What about you?
So my background is really different. You know, interestingly, we're both suburban California kids of kind of middle class backgrounds, you being Southern California, me being Northern California. But I came to it from a cinephile's point of view, in that it's funny you should mention The Lord of the Rings, because that was one of the first like dense books that I definitely quit reading. And I did read the first two, and I got about 50 pages into Return of the King, and I was like, hard pass. This is like fucking Genesis, right? It's just like lists of people and their relatives. And then I tried to read Dune a couple of different times and really disliked it. Like, I really disliked it in trying to read it. And I put it down and never took it back. But at the time that the original 84 Dune came out, I definitely was into David Lynch because of Eraserhead and The Elephant Man. And he was somebody whose work I was interested in. And this was his first foray into big budget filmmaking. And it's hard to think of ways it could suck more. Like, it was just a movie that I detested, Tarek, like absolutely detested. And in a lot of ways, it was one of the first movies that got me thinking about the limitations of auteurism, right? Because there's like that, it can work, and certainly it's something to think about, but it's that clash between somebody who's so iconoclastic that that vision just doesn't fit into a big budget Hollywood infrastructure, whereas his follow-up films to this, Blue Velvet and Wild at Heart, did, right? Significantly more low budget, significantly different audiences intended. And maybe in retrospect, I should go back to Dune, because I might like it more if I look at it as a David Lynch film rather than like a big budget Hollywood special effects extravaganza.
Or maybe the differences that you're discerning there, and I don't know if this is actually the case, but the difference is being that Dune wasn't his story and the other two were. Or I don't know, did he write the other two stories?
Oh yeah, yeah, he did. Although both of them, Blue Velvet has its roots in kind of a weird remake of It's a Wonderful Life. And of course, Wild at Heart is a very strange Wizard of Oz take. So I don't know. I mean, they're entirely original, but they do have the roots in other texts. But it's funny because auteurism is what brought me back to this. I really like, or at least admire, a lot of the director Denis Villeneuve's work. So I was excited to see it. I was excited to see what he would do with this.
Absolutely, me too. I am, well, I'm a huge fan of Blade Runner 2049. I know that you're a little bit more ambivalent about, I think.
No, I'm not ambivalent. I don't like it. Like, I definitely don't like it. I don't find it completely devoid of things to appreciate. Again, there's lots that he does that I really like. His concern, scope and scale and imagination and vision. I just wasn't super enraptured by the story. And I thought the final battle in that film was silly, even though I loved the final scene.
I'm not interested in battles. In fact, one of the things that I want to gloss over when I see movies like the contemporary Dune, the one that we're talking about, are the battle scenes. I get so bored with battle scenes. It just, you know, when you're reading them in the books, they're usually relatively brief, but when you're seeing them on the screen, they just linger and linger. And I'm just not interested in another fight scene. First of all, the 1984 fight scenes that David Lynch set out, they suffer equally from, well, they induce boredom in me.
So I think a lot of movies suffer from what I would call Michael Bayism, in that the action is cut so frenetically and oftentimes without any regard to continuity that they're kind of messy and hard to follow. And one of the things I really liked about this movie is I thought it was really cleanly and fluidly cut. So the action was very simple to watch. And so I wasn't as bored by the battle scenes as I am in a lot of those action movies.
Certainly. I mean, it's no superhero movie, right? It's not action, 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 action. But I've been so compelled by this story of Dune for so long that, I mean, again, I can't really give a kind of neutral or fair evaluation. I've been waiting for this damn movie forever, right? Since I was a little kid. And David Lynch did not cut it for me. I've been hearing about this Denis Villeneuve film for 6 or 7 years now. Been thinking and thinking and thinking and just hoping. And so now, I just want to see the damn movie. Forget about the fight scenes. Like, tell me what happens with Jessica and Paul. Tell me what happens with, you know, shout out Mapes. Tell me what happens with, yeah, I want the story. So
let's talk about that. I want to talk about, so you did like it, yes?
Oh, yeah, I loved it. I've seen it 4 times.
So you've seen it 4 times on TV.
At home.
Right?
Yeah.
At home. Professor of Film and Media Studies, folks. Media Studies.
Professor of Film and Media Studies.
So, shockingly, I saw it in the movie theater, right? What a surprise. And I don't know how you watch this at home, Tarek. I don't understand. Like, it is such a visual extravaganza. And one of the things that's like a hallmark of Villeneuve films is music. Like, his music and sound design are incredible. Mm-hmm. And I first noticed that in Sicario, mm-hmm. right? Which is just, the music was unbelievable in that. And the music and the sound design in this are just unreal. So good, like to the point where my 14 and 17-year-old kids both talked about the sound afterwards. And admittedly, they're a little more cinephilic than your normal kid, but they were just like, oh my God, Dad, that was amazing. What was going on there? Like, and then it was just visually like, beautiful. It was beautiful. And it played on the biggest screen. When I saw it, it was in the biggest screen in our local theater, which is really nice, you know, big screen with great digital sound. And it was this all-consuming cinematic experience where you go in and you think to yourself, this is why they make movies. Because it wasn't just a superhero movie, even though it is like a superhero movie. It's interesting that the trailer before this was The Matrix for Matrix Resurrections. And it was hard not to think like, I'm kind of watching the same movie going on here in some ways, right? The Savior comes in. And even though I haven't read all 6 books, I would sense that that's how it's going to end up.
No, he's not a savior. He turns into a bad guy. He kills in the very next book. The very kind of very introductory scenes, he admits that he's responsible for the murder of 80 billion people.
Did you just literally fuck up this whole thing for me?
Well, I mean, I don't know that he'll ever even get to book 2. So you can think of him as the savior in this film. Absolutely.
Well, they're definitely making a second movie.
Second movie of the first book.
Okay.
But I want to get back to defending myself for the TV part or for the not watching it in films part, in the theater part. in my defense, I got a big TV, I got a big stereo, sounds good, looks good. I know it's not the same thing as the movies, but, you know, it was enough for me. I mean, visually, stunning, absolutely. And sound, like the very beginning, the very, very first sound you hear is that kind of, that Tuvan throat singing stuff of the Sardaukar call to arms. And it yeah, man, it just kind of sets you up. Like, you're ready. Like, you're ready to, like, be in that world. And, the sound is amazing. I've listened to a number of interviews with Hans Zimmer, the composer, and just fascinated by their attention to detail. All of them were compelled to think so specifically about the sound and the images that you see in this film that, yeah, the attention to detail is absolutely amazing.
So I have some questions as our resident Dune expert. So I will tell you that I did not love the movie, but I didn't hate the movie. And I'm glad that I saw it on the screen. But my complaint with the movie is what I like to call the Harry Potter problem. And I really dislike the first. I dislike most of the Harry Potter films, to be honest with you, but I especially dislike the first two. And then you get the Prisoner of Azkaban and it's great. And I would talk to students in particular who had all read the books, and they would lecture me on scenes that had to be in the movie because they were in the books. Right. And I, of course, would say, that's not a movie, right? Just mm-hmm. adapt it, slim it down. Mm-hmm. So I really liked the acting in this. I thought it was excellent. I loved the visuals of it. And I thought the storytelling was way too complex. I'm not a moron. I got the basic idea. He's stuck on that planet and he's gonna align with the
Fremen.
Oh, of course, he's gonna align with them and battle the Empire, whatever it is. But I don't, like, it's really weird that you're talking about Arabic names and these unpronounceable things and this, like, weird thing. And then there's, like, Paul. Mm-hmm. And Duncan, like, it makes no sense that there's that. And then why, if the emperor was just gonna go against Paul's family, why did he give them that planet in the first place? And what is with the voice? And is it only supposed to be ladies that have it, like women, and somehow he's taught it? Like, it seemed, for such a simple story, when you think of something like Lord of the Rings, it is little dude must throw ring in volcano, right? And 12 hours later, you get to the end of the three movies. But I think the story, from my understanding of it, without all the nuance and without having read the books, is super simple at its core and appealing, right? But it's also, like, I just thought the storytelling was way too complicated. And for me, the movie did not take off. I was bored to tears for the first hour or so, and then it took off, and we'll talk about that when we get there. So fill me in on this background and why I should care about these details.
Well, first of all, I'm not going to fill you in on the background, because the movie is the movie. You saw what you saw, right? You saw, and it's what I'm always telling students, like, whatever's on the screen is what is there. And so I find myself incapable, really, of answering that question, because I didn't watch the movie like you did. I watched the movie with knowledge of everything that happened in the book. And more than that, with kind of, you know, over the years, reading books about the book or hearing people talk about the book. I mean, I've been involved in the universe for so long. My version of watching this was, you know, opposite to yours, waiting. So, all right, is the box going to come out? When is he going to put his hand in the box? Okay. When is Jessica going to, I know everything's going to happen. So for me, it's just a matter of, did he do it right or did he not do it right? Which is not really a fair way to watch a movie. When I watched this movie, I watched it with my wife, who is not a sci-fi fan at all. And I had to struggle to make her even watch this. She liked it, but she also got really sick of me saying, oh, that is, you know, that she is a part of the Bene Gesserit. And the Bene Gesserit are, you know, this order of kind of nun-like women who rule the universe through a breeding program. And yeah, I shouldn't have to tell her those things. They should just be there. So I really wouldn't know how to answer you. I don't know how to watch this movie without knowing the Dune universe.
See, and I respect that, because you had that knowledge going into it. And I'm sure there are movies that I have that understanding with. But I would argue a successful adaptation of a book is one where the viewer can have no foreknowledge whatsoever of it and still get something out of the movie. And while I think that I got the basics of it, yes?
Yeah.
I did. Okay. So while I think that I got the basics of it, and I'm looking forward to the second one, I just thought it was way too bogged down in details that didn't matter to the non-reader. And is the number of readers, like when we were kids, these books were big deals. Mm-hmm. Like they were hugely popular in the 70s and throughout the 80s. Are they still popular in the way they once were? I don't know. I'm out of touch with that world.
Yeah, they're absolutely still popular. But I mean, you touch on Denny Villeneuve, who I've seen multiple interviews with, because again, I'm obsessed with this universe, is like me. He's trying to kind of satisfy a couple of different worlds. One, the world of his imagination, which is the most important part. And two, the world of filmgoers. And those are two different things. His imagination is just as steeped and obsessed with this book as mine is. And so he had to, there was no getting around, he had to include those details which tripped you up or which might have been boring for you or which might have been only partially relevant for you. At the same time, he had to make, you know, satisfy the requirements of a big budget film, meaning he had to make something that a whole bunch of people were going to watch and be interested in. So I admire that he was able to pull it off in the way that he did. This movie seems to be getting universal praise from folks across the spectrum. At the same time, there was no way he was ever going to satisfy everybody in that. There's no way. There's no way he's going to satisfy cinephiles and the kind of obsessive and loud fans of the book and the universe, the ones who are still furious about the 1984 version and how that didn't go right. And so, yeah, I think he did a good job given the circumstances. I wouldn't want to direct. What was the budget of that film? $200 million?
At least. Yeah. And probably more. Like what doesn't get factored into the budget is the interest on the note. When you hold that movie for so long, like you're paying money on it, you know, once you release it, you can start paying that back and you eventually want to get in the black. But that's like the secret sauce of the pandemic that people didn't realize that was so difficult for films like No Time to Die, like the sheer amount of money that people spent on that. And then they're paying interest on it while they're waiting for this time where you can release it and make $1 billion, which in fact, maybe you can never do again. Who knows? Like that time might be over. Now, No Time to Die is a little different. It's an MGM production. If we're going to talk industrially, Dune having this relationship, Warner Brothers having this relationship with HBO Max, it's very different because it's content and their sense is not exclusively, like the value of this movie to the parent company is not exclusively measured in box office, it's measured in subscriptions. Mm-hmm. So if people subscribe to HBO and then look at the other content and decide, hey, we're going to keep doing this, and maybe they stay subscribers for a year or more, well, that is ultimately as valuable or maybe even more so than that $1 billion at the box office that actually just stops once it's because nobody buys DVDs anymore or anything like that, right? You don't have the same kind of secondary life from it. So again, these companies, whether it's Netflix, HBO, et cetera, all they'll do is say that it was really successful, but the numbers are proprietary. They do not release them. But there is no reason to believe that this film wasn't a success for HBO Max, even as Denis Villeneuve does not want the next one released on HBO.
Who would? I mean, if you're making, you know, spending that much time, then you're going to get fools like me watching it at home. Exactly in the opposite way that he intended it to be watched. So I don't blame him for doing that. At the same time, just as a me, as a person, as a lazy person, I'm really grateful. I got to sit at home on my couch repeatedly and watch this movie. And I mean, you know, in a nod to you and your world, I did turn the lights off. I watched it in the dark.
You know, I would not say that I went over the top in my COVID fear, but I certainly took precautions and, you know, 3 times vaccinated, as I know you are as well. But the movie theater here in town, we live in a very small town, and I'm scared that it's going to go out of business. It's Cinemark that runs it. But one of the joys for me right now in this hopefully tail end of COVID, or at least somewhere in the COVID process, is like, I can go to the movies again. And I go all the time. I'm going 2 or 3 times a week, like I always did. So that part of my life is back. But man, I can't tell you how many movies I've seen with either nobody else that didn't come with me or like 2 or 3 people. We saw Dune. There was probably 7 or 8 people in the audience in a theater that has got to hold 250. And that can't go on forever. And Tarek, I lived in Walla Walla when there was no movie theater. And it was the worst, like 2 years of my life.
It how much did it cost you to get into the movie theater? What's it cost these days? Is it the same as it was before the pandemic?
So you're going to laugh at me. I don't even know. I'm at a point in my life where I've just got the app and I don't really care what a movie costs. So I just download it. And that's that. I love the Cinemark like loyalty app, their specialty app. I don't know. It's something like anywhere, depending on which one you go to. I think it's $5.50 for the first showing of the day on Saturdays and Sundays, which I go to a lot because it's dirt cheap to do that. Although it's not always that cheap for the big films like that first week. And then I think the nighttime is something like $11. Like it's a lot cheaper. It's the same movie as it is in New York or LA, but it's a lot cheaper to go see it. Mm. Okay. So I got to ask another follow-up question though. I don't understand why the Arabic stuff is in this at all. So tell me the background and why Herbert chose to do that and what was his intent and what do you think the result of it was?
I mean, I'm really fascinated with this question because, well, I'm fascinated. Let me just very briefly, Frank Herbert was living in Florence, Oregon, just right over there, the dunes, you know where the dunes
are? Yeah, no pun intended.
Yeah, no pun intended. He was assigned, he was a journalist at the time, freelance journalist, and he was assigned an article to write about the dunes in Florence. Nothing to do with the Arab world or any of that. And it just kind of got him thinking about ecology and land management. And eventually that kind of, he started writing, it just put the idea in his head. Well, what civilization 20,000 years in the future, that is, you know, no water on the planet, everything's kind of shifting dunes. And then in order to kind of put that story, he did a lot of research and incorporated elements from the Arab world and then the larger Islamic world. There's words in there from Arabic, from Persian, from Turkish. He also kind of incorporated Jewish and Buddhist mystical ideas to kind of compose his world. But most of that world is kind of structured around, you know, he's writing in the 1960s. So think of oil and colonialism in the Middle East in the 1960s. And so oil and equals spice, right? Without spice, you can't travel. Same thing. Without oil, you can't travel. And then the kind of, you know, he's thinking about, you know, this is the time where all these anti-colonial movements are happening. People are throwing the British out. So he's thinking about colonialism. So he's writing a story essentially about colonialism. I know a lot of folks have said that this is a white savior kind of story and criticize it for that. But it's not true. If you actually read the novel, or the whole kind of series of novels, you recognize that Frank Herbert is very critical of kind of the hero complex or a white savior complex. And in fact, again, if you keep going through the novels, Paul is not the hero. He's not evil necessarily, but by kind of having visions of the future, he recognizes his place in time and recognizes that even though he has a whole lot of power, he doesn't have power to actually change the flow of the universe. So he's responsible for killing 80 billion people, but his only kind of argument against that is if I didn't do this, then, you know, 900 billion people would die. He's not good. He's not bad. He's somewhere in between. It's super complicated. So I love his take on kind of colonialism. And so, you know, again, like I wouldn't be interested in this movie if it was just your regular old white savior complex. And that's not what this film is, even though it appears that way.
Huh. It's the Nagasaki Hiroshima argument, right?
This yeah, essentially.
Save. So tell me this. So in seeing Sand Dunes, he literally thought of the Middle East, right?
Eventually he came to that idea, right? But first he thought of ecology. First he thought of, you know, what happens when you try to control the world, the environment around you, and, you know, either succeed or fail. Because they were trying to control those dunes in Florence are always crawling over Highway 1, I think, or 101. And the point of the article was, how do we stop the dunes from, you know, encroaching onto this our settlement? That's what got him thinking. That's just kind of essentially what the story is about. How do we re-engineer this entire planet? And in fact, he does turn the planet green in book 4 or 5 or something like that.
So without, I'm not going to read the second book, so okay. I'm okay with you having spoiled that, but don't spoil the first one for me.
Okay.
Will this have a contained end? Is there an ending? Like in the second part, can they complete the first, like, will there be a self-contained 2-film story when this is over?
Absolutely. Frank Herbert's first book, I believe, even though it was serialized, was meant to be kind of a contained, you know, beginning, middle, and an end. So there is an end. You will meet the Emperor. More battles will happen. Bigger and bigger battles will happen, and excitement will brew. In fact, the first part of the book is so much of the kind of world building. There's not much action. There's a little bit, like when the Atreides get kind of kicked out of power, but yeah, most of the second part of the book is going to actually take place within the Fremen Sietch, they call it, within the Fremen home. And I think it will become a lot more interesting. All that said, I'm still pissed off they didn't choose any Arab actors. Like, they could have. How hard would that have been?
So I don't know. And that, like, so is it taking Arab, like, ideas and words, or is it actually supposed to be Arab?
Wow.
So that complicates the question.
It's totally complicated. I was listening to a podcast, Throughline, it's called, I think it's NPR, a great podcast. And there were some Arab Americans and Muslim Americans in general. I don't know specifically where they were from, but they were talking about this movie. And I think in a way that just didn't disturb me per se, but I just thought it was a little bit just simplistic. What they were saying was, hey man, this is our story. And you, Denis Villeneuve, are messing it up. You didn't hire any Arab actors. You eliminated the word jihad from it. You kind of scrubbed it, you know, scrubbed the Arab parts out, which I think is hilarious, because what I was thinking the whole time is, what are you seeing? This is not our story. Frank Herbert is not called Ihab Herbert. Like, you know, he's not from Sudan. He's from the United States. And he's writing. He was kind of, in a way, I mean, I think, in a super interesting way, he was taking stories from the Middle East and taking kind of the colonial situation and writing about that. It's not our story. I felt called to it just because my, you know, little 1970s mind, this is the only kind of bit of popular culture that even recognized me as a human being. So I was happy about that, but it's not my story. I've made it my story over the years, so I get where they're coming from, but it's not my story. I didn't write this story. It's not a Muslim or Arab story. This is just a story that considers Muslims or Arabs from a relatively neutral or even positive perspective, but it's not our story. So I don't know that we can really complain. That being said, and as much as I love Javier Bardem and all of those Fremen that were in the film, you could have hired a couple Arabs. Like, how hard is it? Or you could have at least hired some Arabs to consult, to think about what this kind of, you know, Islam-inspired culture 20,000 years from now would look like. But at the same time, you know, Denis Villeneuve said very clearly, repeatedly, Dune, the novel, was my Bible, and I'm just following the Bible. So, and he did that. Fair enough.
Well, that makes sense. And it is, despite having these elements of different cultures, like, its appeal is its universalism, right? It's like so many cultures have a similar kind of mythos attached to it. So,
well, he's literally talking about the universe.
Yes.
20,000 years in the future.
So in talking to you about how I was really kind of disappointed with the first third or so of the movie. It's a long movie and it feels long. It feels long when you're in the theater. The second that, heavy spoiler alert here, the second that the Duke is killed, Paul's father, or that they descend on the planet to kill him, man, the movie just takes off. At that point, it was, for me, from that moment on, it was thrilling. I thoroughly enjoyed it. It was super exciting, and it's classic, like, escape, right? It's like this thing happens and he needs to escape from the danger that he finds himself in and to find safe haven. But that's movies, right? We've seen that over and over and over again in movies, and I just thought this was really well done and thrilling to watch.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, but as you're describing the very complicated nature of the world building part, it had to be done. Like, you couldn't just, I mean,
did it?
Yeah, it had to be done. Otherwise, then it's not Dune. It's something else. Something maybe equally interesting, but I mean, you know, you had to show the 12 palm trees that were there, for example, to talk about how scarce the water is there. You had to show the Fremen with their blue eyes to talk about kind of, you know, the addiction to spot. You had to show all that stuff that will later become relevant, But yeah, you're right. The action didn't really. But again, for me, I don't really care about that. All I was waiting for was the right boxes to be ticked. I did not approach this movie the way I normally approach movies. I was not kind of filled with joy, and I was just waiting for what I know to be true to finally be true, to be made manifest before me. And, you know, that's not the best way to approach a movie.
I want a movie to move. I want them to embrace their namesake. But it doesn't have to be movement in the guise of action. It can be movement in the form of narrative propulsion, right? Mm-hmm. It can be world building, driving forward. And for me, I found the world building unnecessarily complex, with the caveat that there is an audience that needs to be satisfied that will come in with that. So it's a really fine line that he's got to walk, where he's got to satisfy the people that have read the book and are really devotees of it. And also people like me that just want to go see a movie, either because they like him or they like movies and they want to see what's going on. And I would say that for the most part, he did it. I think it's a really successful version of something that's really hard to do. Even as, again, I didn't love it, I sure liked it. Mm-hmm. I sure liked it.
Well, I think he was struggling with the fact that as much as I love that book and all the books, Frank Herbert wasn't the most, how do I put it? Not the most economical writer, right? He rambles on at length. He introduces topics and then forgets about them and then comes back to them later. So if you think about the characters in Dune, there are too many damn characters. Like, you've got Duncan Idaho, and you've got, who's the other guy? The other military guy that was played by Josh Brolin.
Gurney Halleck.
Why you have two like military figures, both of who are, you know, are their jobs consist of advising the Duke on how to deal. Why do you have two? Why not just have one? Right. So if you're making a film, you certainly wouldn't have had two. Or shout out Mapes, the maid who brought a knife that Jessica found. Well, she has a role in the film, and that role is to kind of serve as a connection back to the Fremen. That didn't come out in the film. And so, but you have to kind of tick those boxes. For me, he had to tick those. He had to have shout out Mapes. He had to have both of those characters. But as far as economical storytelling goes, no. Yeah, way too many damn characters to remember. Way too many faces to remember. Way too many stories and narratives. It worked for me. But again, like, it was gonna, you know, I came prepared. I came like preloaded to love this stuff.
Well, and I think that you say he goes on and on and on. It kind of brings this conversation full circle, and it's a good place to stop. It's Tolkien. Like, there's a lot of Tolkien in that version of it. And like, contemporarily, it's hard not to think of George R. R. Martin.
Oh, yeah. Or it's just better than that, though. I mean, yeah, absolutely. And there's it's not an accident that, you know, well, I think it was fifth grade, Mrs. Petlack at Garden Elementary in Riverside, California, made me read The Hobbit. That was the first book I ever read, first novel I ever read. I'd read lots of little kids' books before then. And I was mystified. And so immediately I read Lord of the Rings. The minute I finished Lord of the Rings, I was like, more, give me more, give me other worlds. Let me get out of this horrible Southern California stinky world that I live in. I want more worlds. And Dune made perfect sense. So it is in keeping with that kind of tradition. And as far as a book goes, absolutely fabulous. But as far as a film goes, man, I'm impressed that Denis Villeneuve did what he did. I don't know that anybody could really make a tight film with a story that is so vast.
If you're going to adhere as diligently as he did, with
right,
that fidelity to the story. I mean, I think you could make a quick, clean film, but maybe
like David Lynch?
David Lynch can't do anything quick and clean. Like, I think of Inland Empire when I think of David Lynch, or the last version of Twin Peaks, which was just, people love it. I was not one of those people.
Incomprehensible.
Yeah.
I saw it. Actually, I was traveling. I was on a motorcycle trip, and I watched it in the hotel room. And I remember just the scene where there was this droning. It was like Eraserhead. There was this droning music, I don't know, for 5 minutes. And the character was just staring at the camera. And I thought, all right, something's going to happen. And I kept watching. Nothing happened. Yeah, David Lynch. I don't know. You got to love him. He made me love film when I was young. Blue Velvet was one of my favorite films, even though I felt like a creep for liking it, but not Dune. Dune was terrible.
It was. It was obnoxiously bad. Yeah. But then
Sting, you remember Sting in his underwear dancing around?
Like, and Kyle MacLachlan, and who would go on to be in the TV, the original ABC, I think it was, version of Twin Peaks. Well, Tarek, we've been friends and colleagues for 7 years, and I've asked you a number of times to be on the podcast.
Guilt trip coming.
No guilt trip. I'm grateful that you agreed to finally, after 7 years of friendship, to come on the departmental podcast that's the product of the department in which we both work. It was a true pleasure to Absolutely. Talk about this movie with you. Thank you very much. So I'm Robert Sickles for Tarek Alsiwi, and this has been the Cold Open number 41.